not being helped, they are being left alone. So do they have the capabilities to fight against Zionist Israel?
In truth, putting aside the official position, which has come to rely on options that have proven ineffective, the popular reality is different. Yes, Syrians suffer from many crises. They face severe economic, social, and military challenges, especially after the Israeli entity destroyed much of the Syrian army's capabilities. But a popular resistance movement does not require extensive resources. A small amount of equipment, paired with the will to resist, is enough to build a formidable resistance experience, one capable of posing a significant challenge to the occupation. Ultimately, the matter hinges on popular will, on the readiness to confront and sacrifice in order to achieve the desired outcomes.
I want to thank you very much, Mr. Hassan Hijazi, political commentator, expert in Zionist affairs, for joining us to talk about the pressing matter of southern Syria against the Zionist Israeli entity's incursions. Ladies and gents, thank you. Please do follow us to get more updates about the region of West Asia right here on the Mideast Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
The following is part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with school and university students. The meeting took place in the Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Alayhi Husayniyah on November 3rd, 2025, on the eve of Student Day and the National Day of Fighting Global Arrogance. From the time of the Constitutional Revolution till roughly 40 years later, our country was either in a state of chaos and turmoil. It was subject to the meddling of foreign governments, or it was under the brutal, merciless despotism and dictatorship of Reza Khan. This lasted for about 42 years, which means the Iranian nation lived in such a state for several decades. Around 1949 or 1950, certain events unfolded in the country. By God's grace, a national government was formed for the first time in the country, the government of Mossadegh. It was a national government. A national government was formed that stood up to the British. Britain, at the time, was in effect the ruler of the world. It was more superior, stronger, and bigger than all other powers. The country's oil was being given to the British almost for free. It was taken back from them, and using the language of that time, it was nationalized. This means that it was brought under the control of our own government, and a national government was established in Iran. During the 3 years from 1950 to 1953, the conspiracies of the British and their allies brought immense pressure on this government in order to overthrow it.
Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah.
Mossadegh was naive and made an unwitting mistake. In order to free himself from the British, he turned to the US and asked them for help. The US smiled at him. Of course, there was the precedent of Truman's Point 4 program, and there were other similar policies too, which led him to believe that the United States would support him. The US smiled at Mossadegh, but behind his back, they took advantage of Mossadegh's oversight and inattention. They colluded with the British, they orchestrated a coup, and they overthrew the national government that had been formed in the country after 40 years. They then brought back the Shah, who had fled the country. This was a severe blow to the Iranian nation. The meaning of the 28th of Mordad is precisely this. It means that a government elected by the people, which did not want to be at the disposal of Britain and foreign colonialism, and wanted to be a national government, was toppled and destroyed by the US through their use of all sorts of tricks.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Flash of white light lit up the sky over Gaza tonight. People running for cover, not knowing whether they're dead or alive. They came with their tanks and their planes, with ravaging fiery flames, and nothing remains. Just a voice rising up in the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight. Women and children alike, murdered and massacred night after night. While the so-called leaders of countries afar debated on who's wrong or right. But their powerless words were in vain, and the bombs fell down like acid rain. Through the tears and the blood and the pain, you could still hear that voice through the smoky haze. We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will
if we were able to target cancer cells directly without affecting the healthy tissue surrounding it? Well, that's exactly what the scientists here at the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran have been able to do using yttrium-90. So in this week's episode of Iran Tech with me, your host Ali Reza, we're going to dive deep into how yttrium-90 can be used to target cancer cells in the liver directly without affecting the healthy tissue surrounding it. Stay tuned. Let's clarify something first. When I say liver cancer, I don't mean just the type of cancer that the cancer tumors that originate from within the liver. I also mean other types of cancers that have metastasized, and you can find the metastasized cancer tumors inside the liver as well, which actually makes up the majority of liver cancer cases. And treating liver cancer has been traditionally difficult using surgery and chemotherapy because only about 30% of actual patients qualify to get these treatments. And, you know, speaking of the treatments, chemotherapy itself is unpleasant, and we all know it. You lose body hair, your body is weak. There's plenty of reasons to try to avoid it if you can. And you can using this groundbreaking technology. Microspheres that contain yttrium-90, these tiny glass beads with this radioactive isotope, the radioisotope of yttrium, not the neutral yttrium-89, the radioactive one, yttrium-90. So you can inject these tiny glass beads into the bloodstream, into the blood supply of the cancer tumors, and it can selectively, using selective internal radiation therapy, SIRT, it can target those cancer cells directly and, you know, leave everything else untouched. So this is how yttrium-90 can help treat liver cancer. So first, we're going to learn about how it's made, and then we're going to take a closer look at how it works.
Our particle manufacturing process as microspray involves several stages. To create the particle, we first combine the raw materials and form a suspension. We then synthesize them using the Sol-Gel method to achieve the desired chemical composition. After completing the Sol-Gel process, the next step is drying to obtain the target powder. Subsequently, to achieve the intended structural properties, biocompatibility, and a specific characteristic termed patyl, the synthesized powder undergoes heat treatment at a controlled temperature. Following this, the sample is milled, and the insert process, a term used for spheroidization, is performed to shape the particles into spheres. Once spheroidization is complete, the particles are spherical, but exhibit a broad size distribution, ranging from approximately 15 to 20 micrometers. However, the final product requires particles between 10 to 20 micrometers. To achieve this, we perform particle size classification using mechanical sieving, mechanical screening. After sieving, quality control, QC, is conducted under a microscope. The particles are then sterilized, packaged into specialized vials, and sent for irradiation.
These microspheres, these tiny glass beads that contain yttrium-90, they need to be a very specific size, between 20 to 40, 50 microns, so basically thinner than a hair strand. And they need to be exactly that size, or exactly within that range, because if they are too small, then they could essentially seep into other organs of the body. If they are too big, they will just get lodged into the main vessel that is going into the liver. So it needs to be, the size needs to be just right. So once they are injected, they'll essentially lodge themselves around the area where the cancer tumor is getting fed from the blood supply. And they start emitting beta rays that start to shrink the cancer tumor by destroying the DNA of the cancer tumor. And that way, it'll gradually shrink down and get replaced by healthy cells to the point that we can hopefully say that the cancer tumor is essentially gone. And it's compared to the typical external radiation methods, you know, you have to do multiple hospital visits, whereas this is a one-time injection, which is also a lot more precise, hence the selective internal radiation therapy, SIRT. So we're going to take a closer look at how this process works first, and then talk about the broader implications of it.
The patient is first prepared with mild sedation and local anesthesia at the groin. A small incision is made to allow insertion of a catheter into the femoral artery. Using real-time imaging, the catheter is carefully navigated through the arterial network until it reaches the hepatic artery, the main vessel supplying the liver. At this point, a carefully measured suspension of yttrium-90 loaded glass microspheres is injected directly into the hepatic artery. These microspheres, each between 20 and 50 microns in diameter, travel with the bloodstream until they lodge in the tiny arterioles feeding the tumor. Their small size ensures that they preferentially accumulate in the tumor's vascular bed while bypassing much of the healthy tissue. Once the microspheres are in place, they begin to emit beta radiation. This form of radiation penetrates only a few millimeters, targeting the tumor cells while largely sparing the surrounding healthy liver tissue. The beta particles disrupt the DNA within cancer cells, impairing their ability to divide and triggering cell death. This localized radiation gradually shrinks the tumor over several days, as the continuous emission of energy damages the cancer cell's structural integrity. The entire injection process typically takes between 60 to 90 minutes. In the days following the treatment, the microspheres continue to emit radiation, steadily damaging the tumor from within. Throughout this process, the targeted nature of the therapy minimizes systemic side effects typically seen with the traditional chemotherapy or external radiation. By concentrating the therapeutic effects directly at the tumor site, normal liver function is largely preserved, and patients often experience a significant improvement in their quality of life. The precision of this treatment reduces complications and supports a quicker recovery, allowing patients to resume their normal activities sooner. This method represents a significant advance in the treatment of liver cancer, offering a minimally invasive alternative that delivers high doses of radiation directly to the tumor while minimizing exposure to healthy tissues.
It is important to note that the yttrium or Newell glass microspheres injected into patients are biocompatible. The particle size for these microspheres is within the 40 to 50 micron range. Particles smaller than 50 microns risk passing through hepatic capillaries and leaking into the lungs. Particles larger than 50 microns avoid this issue, as they do not migrate from blood vessels into the liver mass. Due to these critical size-dependent effects, strict quality control, QC testing, is performed on the particles to ensure their size falls within the specified range.
The yttrium glass microspheres discussed here are not our primary focus. However, they represent the latest achievement of the radiotherapy equipment research laboratories at the Nuclear Science and Technology Research Institute and are classified as medical devices. This technology serves as a non-surgical alternative for inoperable tumors, either as a standalone treatment or in combination with chemotherapy. A key advantage of this method over conventional radiotherapy is its ability to spare healthy liver tissues, which are highly sensitive to radiation, thereby minimizing adverse side effects. We selected a product with a 100-day time frame to enable faster commercialization and market readiness. Currently, our laboratory focuses on producing internal radiotherapy products, including brachytherapy techniques. These are targeted therapeutic methods capable of localized treatment of tumor tissues. Producing these devices positions us as a regional hub for advancing medical tourism. It is worth noting that our laboratory is the only active facility in the country and the broader region, excluding Russia, specializing in the production of medical radioactive sources. This grants us significant potential in medical tourism. The production of yttrium-90 glass microspheres has already been successfully implemented at the Nuclear Science and Technology Research Institute. The pilot scale production stages are now complete. The animal phase has been completed, and all necessary tests, including toxicity, dimensional, and density tests, which are specific to the production process, have been conducted. The physical parameters of the product align with those of commercial sources, and from our perspective, this phase is fully accomplished. However, to enter the market, it was imperative to conduct the clinical phase to determine the product's efficacy. We are currently carrying out the clinical phase in collaboration with Shahid Beheshti University of Medical Sciences. Approximately 20 patients have been treated with this product so far. Initial results reported by the treating physicians have been satisfactory, meeting the parameters we prioritize, such as absence of toxicity, no leakage to other organs, and concentration in liver tissue. These outcomes have been observed and documented in several early-stage treatment cases. Indeed, the preliminary results have been declared promising. These results may include reductions in tumor size, tumor necrosis, decreased vascularization, diminished blood supply to the tumor tissue, and I would like to highlight reduced metabolic activity within the tumor area. Fortunately, the outcomes thus far have been encouraging. God willing, upon completing the clinical phase and analyzing the results, we will proceed to secure the required permits from the Ministry of Health, Treatment, and Medical Education to introduce this product to the market and commence its commercial distribution.
Today we showed you how our scientists are working hard to cause a breakthrough and sort of a revolution in liver cancer treatment in Iran using these microspheres that contain yttrium-90, the radioisotope of yttrium, which, fun fact, is actually being produced inside this nuclear power reactor because you need a reactor to create radioisotopes. And we're waiting for the final stages of the clinical trials to get the approval to be able to produce it at scale, to become only the second country in the world to be able to produce these yttrium-90 radioisotopes at scale for commercial use. So we're hoping for that to happen sooner rather than later. And with that said, we've come to the end of this episode of Iran Sig.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners. You're tuned into Iran Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Tehran. I am Masuma, and it is a pleasure to be with you this Saturday. We've got more enriching content lined up for the rest of the hour, so let's take a look at what's coming your way. Next, we'll bring you Iran Today, your gateway to in-depth coverage of key developments within the Islamic Republic of Iran, from advancement in science, technology, to updates on the economy and business sectors. This program offers exclusive insights and interviews you won't want to miss. After that, enjoy another round of radio productions. Stay tuned.
The 8-year defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
On November 20th, inside a packed IAEA Board of Governors meeting room in Vienna, a familiar drama played out once again. With 19 votes in favor, the European Troika, joined by Washington, pushed through yet another resolution demanding that Iran fully and immediately expand cooperation with nuclear inspectors. The text calls on Tehran to hand over precise data about its 60% enriched uranium stockpiles and to open the gates of its nuclear facilities to agency personnel, among many other demands. But Tehran saw this coming. Iranian diplomats had warned that any new hostile measures would reflect Western political ambitions, not nuclear facts. And they point to what they call the real trigger for today's crisis: the June attacks on Iran's safeguarded nuclear facilities carried out by the United States and the Israeli regime. Once again, Iran's peaceful nuclear program has become a convenient stage for political theater, pressure that has never succeeded in stopping Iran from pursuing its legitimate nuclear rights.
It's a game that seems to never end. That's how Iran frames the IAEA's approach, a process designed to keep Tehran in a permanent limbo until it yields to Western demands. Russia, China, and Niger voted against the resolution. 12 other countries abstained. The split vote underscored a truth everyone in the room already knew. The board is deeply polarized and nowhere close to consensus. In a joint statement, 8 countries, that is Belarus, China, Cuba, Iran, Nicaragua, Russia, Venezuela, and Zimbabwe, condemned the U.S. and Israeli attacks on Iranian nuclear facilities and denounced the push for a new resolution. They urge member states to resist politicizing Iran's nuclear file and reject the draft entirely. While the resolution ultimately passed, the combined 12 abstentions and 3 no votes revealed what Iran called a gap between reality and truth inside the agency. Dr. Afifeh Abedi, a prominent journalist and foreign policy researcher, provided us with her analysis of the vote's composition.
در ادامه این روند به نظر میرسه که قطعنامه هم که از طرف شورای حکام
It appears that the resolution adopted by the Board of Governors with a very narrow and fragile margin, as you know, it received 19 votes in favor and the combined number of votes against and abstentions was almost the same, can once again be described as a political move designed to serve the maximum pressure campaign pursued by the West and the Zionist regime against Iran.
Tehran went further, describing the resolution as an unconstructive attempt by the European Troika and the U.S. to compensate for their failed snapback attempt at the U.N.
Senior political analyst Dr. Hossein Kanani Moghaddam offered further insight into the resolution.
The core content of this resolution is to impose a three-month deadline, after which the case would be referred to the UN Security Council, enabling the Council to pass a resolution against Iran and take action. If we think of this resolution as a nuclear reactor, the core of that reactor, in terms of impact, is that it confirms the snapback mechanism, reinstates the six previous resolutions, and once again alleges Iran's lack of cooperation. It does not call for the suspension of Iran's nuclear activities, but for their complete shutdown. It also reinforces the requirement for Iran to return to the safeguards agreement it accepted and signed in 2003, an agreement that is binding and legally enforceable because it clearly outlines Iran's obligations. This resolution effectively revives Iran's file, which was close to being removed from the Board of Governors' agenda. It states that in every upcoming board session, Iran's nuclear case must remain one of the items on the agenda.
The irony, Iran notes, is that the IAEA itself has acknowledged the very real consequences of the June attacks. Normal safeguards were disrupted, inspectors were withdrawn, and Iran, saying it acted in good faith, still allowed verification activities to resume at facilities unaffected by the attacks. Grossi's own report recognized Iran's domestic legal requirements and affirmed the agency's commitment to respecting Iranian security concerns.
Yet the sponsors of the resolution barely mentioned any of this. During special board sessions, they avoided reference to the attacks entirely, even though the IAEA's official report documents them.
The EU, speaking for its 27 members, stressed that diplomacy is the only viable path forward. With six UN resolutions reinstated, the EU said all members are now obligated to require Iran to suspend all enrichment, reprocessing, and heavy water activities. The Union insisted Iran had sidestepped its JCPOA commitments for 6 years and that its enriched uranium stockpile has ballooned to nearly 50 times the JCPOA limit. Mr. Hassan Beheshtipour, a senior political analyst, placed the recent resolution against Iran in context.
These resolutions are essentially a continuation of the nuclear case-building process against Iran. Since August 2002, Iran's peaceful nuclear activities were turned into an international issue, and from that point onward, it has been called Iran's nuclear file, while in reality, it's a manufactured file. This case was created for Iran, and one of the main platforms where this case building happens is the IAEA and its Board of Governors. The importance of this resolution is not simply that another resolution has been issued and Iran will not implement it, so it does not matter. It does matter because they are creating documentation against us. When a country is discussed and voted on in a 35-member body, and an 8-paragraph text is issued as a ruling, that text becomes another sheet added to the previous ones. Iran's file at the Board of Governors includes over 120 Director General reports issued every 3 months and more than 40 resolutions. The resolution adopted in this recent round is effectively the 10th in the latest phase. From an international standpoint, the problem is that each new resolution becomes another documented claim layered onto the previous ones, strengthening their narrative. The other key issue is that this gives Germany, the UK, France, and behind the scenes the US and Israel a pretext. They can now cite these resolutions as justification for taking new actions or imposing additional measures against Iran.
According to EU claims, Iran holds more than 440 kilograms of 60% enriched uranium and over 10 significant quantities of highly enriched material. Some of this, they allege, has been unaccounted for over 5 months. With those accusations on the table, the Troika defended their decision to activate snapback, reviving 6 old UN Security Council resolutions and using them as a legal basis for the new joint resolution with Washington. What is the significance of the recent anti-Iranian resolution adopted by the IAEA, and what would be the possible repercussions?
در واقع نتیجه این قدم همون سندسازی که عرض کردم و
One of the outcomes of this resolution is exactly the document building process I mentioned earlier. They are trying to create legitimacy for actions that are in fact illegitimate. When a nuclear site is operating under IAEA supervision, like Fordow, Natanz, or Isfahan, the agency issues detailed reports on them every 3 months. These facilities are inspected, transparent, internationally recognized, and engage in peaceful activity. So when such sites are attacked, that attack is an illegal act under international law because it targets facilities under IAEA oversight that are in full compliance with the NPT. Yet they attempt to justify this unlawful behavior through the very resolutions issued against Iran. Even before the Zionist regime's attack on Iran, a resolution had already been passed, and these resolutions are then used as political cover. In other words, they are manufacturing legitimacy. Under international law, as long as a site is under IAEA supervision and complying with the NPT, no state has the right to attack it. But through these resolutions, they try to turn the situation into a political asset, using it to increase pressure on Iran, push for further isolation, discourage other countries from engaging with Iran, and build negative media narratives. They create a wide range of storylines around these issues. Yet, when you look closely, there is not a single piece of evidence, according to the agency itself, that Iran is pursuing nuclear weapons.
On safeguards, the Europeans argued Iran has delayed verification of enriched materials and failed to implement several NPT obligations. They also insisted that Tehran submit a special report on the damaged facilities, grant access to key sites, and resolve what they call unresolved issues. Unable to meet their own JCPOA commitments, the Europeans now accuse Iran of failing to restore trust and transparency, particularly regarding enriched uranium stockpiles. Dr. Kanani Mokaddam stated that the West's hidden agenda is to overthrow the Islamic Republic. What do you think is the real reason and motivation behind the European Troika's action? And basically, do you think there exists a hidden agenda contrary to what they state and express?
The overarching plan the West is pursuing regarding Iran is essentially a Libya-style model. The idea is to first dismantle Iran's nuclear capabilities and remove its equipment, then intensify pressure on Iran's missile program and regional policies. After that, NATO and the UK would be in a position to carry out military action with ease. And as we saw in Libya, the result of such a model is a country that becomes fragmented, loses its sovereign authority, faces a power vacuum, and is stripped of its capabilities, gaining nothing in return.
We have a lot more to cover today, but first let's take a moment to catch up on the latest headlines.
Hello everyone, welcome to the news section of this program. Here we'll go over some important news headlines. First, Iran condemns draft resolution by US, E3 at IAEA BOG. Iran's permanent representative to the International Atomic Energy Agency, Reza Najafi, censured a draft resolution proposed by the United States and 3 European countries at the IAEA Board of Governors, calling it a bid to impose unjustified and illegal reporting obligations on the United Nations Atomic Agency's Director General Rafael Grossi. The anti-Iranian resolution at the IAEA Board of Governors will not change Iran's status of safeguards implementation, Najafi said ahead of the upcoming BOG meeting, which took place from November 19 to 21 in Vienna. He argued that Washington and the E3 are once again trying to manipulate international mechanisms in order to impose their unreasonable and coercive positions on the Iranian nation. Forcing Grossi to base reports on expired UN Security Council resolutions is not only completely unlawful and unjustified, but will also, in practice, increase existing complexities and deal another setback to diplomacy, the Iranian diplomat added. Iran warns of countermeasures against illegal IAEA resolution. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said Tehran is considering more countermeasures against an illegal resolution adopted by the International Atomic Energy Agency regarding the country's peaceful nuclear program. Ismail Baghaei made the remarks on November 21, one day after the IAEA's 35-member Board of Governors passed the anti-Iran resolution put forward by France, the UK, Germany, and the United States. In response, Tehran announced the termination of the deal it signed in Egypt's Cairo in September to resume cooperation with the UN's nuclear watchdog. The ties had been suspended after the deadly U.S.-Israel aggression against Iran in June. Baghaei said in an official letter to the agency, "We declared that the so-called Cairo agreement, which had been reached with Iran's goodwill and after relatively long negotiations with the agency, is now cancelled. Other measures are also under consideration." Tehran Times. MPs ponder response to IAEA's anti-Iran resolution. The National Security and Foreign Policy Committee of the Iranian Parliament categorically condemned the recently adopted anti-Iran resolution by the Board of Governors of the International Atomic Energy Agency after beginning the process to devise an appropriate response. Ebrahim Rezaei, the spokesperson for the committee, dismissed the resolution as politically motivated and illegal, highlighting the need to show a strong and deterrent reaction to the move. He made the comments following an extraordinary session of the committee attended by Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister and the Deputy Head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran. Rezaei had previously suggested that Tehran leave the NPT. This session was held in order to review the IAEA's recent resolution against the Islamic Republic of Iran, he explained. IRNA. Russia anti-Iran resolution by IAEA BOG is a serious blow to credibility of agency. Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Maria Zakharova said that Russia considers the anti-Iranian and provocative resolution of the International Atomic Energy Agency proposed by the Western camp a serious blow to international confidence in the IAEA safeguards and the nuclear NPT. Reacting to the vote of the IAEA Board of Governors on the draft resolution on the NPT safeguards agreement with the Islamic Republic of Iran, Zakharova said that there is no need for emergency action by the IAEA Board of Governors regarding the verification activities in Iran. The Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson pointed out that the IAEA Secretariat had not requested any instructions from the IAEA Board of Governors. She said that Russia recognizes Iran's continued adherence to its obligations under the NPT and the Comprehensive Safeguards Agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency, despite the U.S. and Israeli attacks on its nuclear facilities under IAEA safeguards in June. And thank you for joining us in this section. Please do stay tuned for the main narrative.
For many years, Iran's peaceful nuclear program has been the target of political pressure and Western allegations. Before the JCPOA, the possible military dimensions file became the centerpiece of sanctions and threats. But when that file was formally closed in 2015, the pretext disappeared, albeit for a while.
After the JCPOA was signed, Iran complied. The United States did not, walking away in 2018. Europe, meanwhile, never delivered the economic benefits it had promised. In response, Iran exercised its JCPOA-defined rights and scaled back commitments. 7 years of diplomacy followed. Iran says it approached negotiations in good faith,
Western governments, however, responded with delays and ever-increasing demands.
When the Zionist regime carried out its illegal attack against Iran and its nuclear facilities, European countries not only refused to condemn it, they even expressed satisfaction. They particularly welcomed any adverse event that might occur in Iran, whether targeting nuclear sites or even affecting Iranian civilians. This clearly shows that the concerns the West claims to have about Iran are not technical at all. They are entirely political. There are numerous precedents for this. Consider the nuclear agreement. When the United States withdrew from the JCPOA, Europe, despite its explicit commitments under the deal, did not activate the snapback mechanism against the US, nor did it uphold its promised cooperation with Iran. In one of the joint meetings about a year after the US withdrawal in 2019, the Europeans made a series of commitments during the session with the JCPOA Joint Commission, yet they failed to fulfill any of them. They even pretended to introduce certain initiatives to preserve the agreement and deliver the economic benefits Iran was supposed to receive, but none of these materialized. In practice, Europe's conduct after the JCPOA and following the US withdrawal demonstrated that they were playing a complementary role to the United States. Europeans maintained a diplomatic facade of commitment, but in reality, they sought to ensure that only Iran remained bound to the agreement, while Iran received none of the benefits it was promised.
On November 20th, Iran's foreign ministry condemned the new resolution as illegal and unjustifiable, imposed under pressure from Washington, London, Paris, and Berlin. Hours later, Iran's foreign minister announced that the Cairo agreement between Iran and the IAEA can no longer be implemented. Tehran notes that 5 months earlier, a biased IAEA report helped clear the way for the June attacks carried out by Israel and the United States. Even then, Iran continued cooperating. Back in September, Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi made a new inspection agreement in Cairo, only for the European Troika and the U.S. to revive snapback once again. Supported by Russia and China, Iran rejected the process as legally invalid.
From Iran's perspective, the West's decision to activate the snapback killed the Cairo agreement outright. Now, Tehran says that the U.S. must answer one basic question. If U.S. President Donald Trump claims that he destroyed Iran's nuclear facilities, then what exactly does the West want to inspect?
The new resolution seeks to revive demands from long-expired U.N. resolutions requiring Iran to suspend enrichment. According to Iran, the board has no legal authority to resurrect terminated Security Council measures. The Troika's attempt to imply such authority exposes bad faith and disregard for IAEA procedures. To Tehran, the text reads like a manifesto of threats aimed at restricting Iran's strategic capabilities, a project championed for decades by the U.S., Europe, and Israel.
Iran has several possible courses of action. The first is a snapback against snapback approach, meaning we raise the cost of such measures to a level that Europeans reconsider exerting pressure on the Islamic Republic. Part of this relates to energy, and part of it concerns international waterways such as Bab al-Mandeb, the Persian Gulf, and the Indian Ocean. Iran has the ability to raise Europe's energy costs to a point where some governments already facing economic crises may regret entering a game designed for them by the Americans. In parts of Europe, there are still rational actors who do not wish to follow U.S. policy line by line. The second path is through diplomacy. We must continue dialogue and emphasize our right to the peaceful use of nuclear energy, a right recognized under international law and accepted by all. We're still within the framework of the NPT. We have not withdrawn, and we should maintain this course to reach a balance between pressures and resistance. The third option is reaching a point of no return, moving the nuclear program to the edge of breakout, enriching up to 90%, conducting a nuclear test, withdrawing from the NPT, and disrupting the regional order the United States seeks to impose. But entering such a path could lead to a conflict whose scope is unknown, including whether it could escalate into a global war.
Yet, Iran emphasizes a key point. Not one IAEA inspection report has ever accused Iran of blocking inspectors. Not one. Before the attacks, Iran had the highest inspection rate in the world. Nearly three-quarters of IAEA verification activities in all safeguard agreement states occurred in Iran. In 2024, the IAEA conducted 1,381 inspector days there. Among 32 countries operating without the additional protocol, Iran, with only 3% of global enrichment capacity, accounted for more than 70% of all inspections. But while Iran's transparency has been unmatched, Israel, armed with an undeclared nuclear arsenal estimated up to 400 warheads and never a member of the NPT, operates outside any inspections. UN Resolution 487 demanded that Israel place its facilities under safeguards. It never has. The result, from Iran's perspective, the IAEA is no longer acting as a neutral arbiter. What was meant to be an impartial watchdog now appears to function as a vehicle for Western political pressure.
به طور خلاصه‌اش اینه که اولا اسرائیل NPT رو نپذیرفته.
In short, Israel has not accepted the NPT, whereas Iran has. Israel is a member of the IAEA, but it has never signed the agency's most fundamental treaty, and because it has not signed it, it does not consider itself bound by it. So why is there no pressure on Israel? Because it's an ally of the United States, Germany, the UK, France, and other dominant powers. In today's world, international law is not what truly governs. Power does. It is power that shapes international relations. That's why Israel, backed by the US, the UK, France, Germany, and others, can simply refuse to join the NPT, remain a member of the IAEA, and at the same time possess more than 300 nuclear warheads. Why cannot Iran do the same? First, because they would never accept it. Iran has fundamentally challenged international order and the existing balance of power. Iran views this system as hegemonic and domineering and is in confrontation with it on various fronts, including the nuclear issue. So it's clear that they will seize on any pretext, including the nuclear file, to prevent Iran from operating outside the NPT framework, even if those activities are purely peaceful. For them, this is a convenient instrument to maintain pressure on a country that has dared to challenge the existing international system.
After 22 years of allegations and political maneuvering, the IAEA Board of Governors' latest resolution confirms that the agency is no longer an independent supervisor. It is an operational arm of Western policy, applying pressure, issuing threats, and advancing a strategy of containment. Tehran views the resolution as the final, unmistakable sign of a system no longer aligned with fairness, impartiality, or the principles of the non-proliferation regime. We asked Dr. Aberi to outline the possible scenarios that lie ahead.
What do you think would be Iran's next move?
It seems the United States and Europe are once again trying to pull Iran back to the negotiating table, but for an unfair agreement, one based on their imposed conditions. One of the key conditions they insisted on in the past and continue to insist on today, despite its illegality, is stripping Iran of its right to uranium enrichment. This, in fact, is the most optimistic scenario. I personally believe there is also a more pessimistic scenario, that the West is not actually seeking oversight of Iran's nuclear program. Rather, they want additional intelligence about the facilities that were attacked and about enriched materials buried beneath them, so they can complete the sabotage of operations previously carried out against Iran's nuclear program. Even in the optimistic scenario, their aim is to shut down Iran's nuclear program and reduce it to whatever level they consider acceptable. There is also a third scenario, neither a new agreement nor a military strike, but instead an escalation of maximum pressure on Iran. To intensify this pressure, they seek a legal mechanism. The Board of Governors resolution is essentially an attempt to give legal cover to the unjust pressure they want to impose. Iran is familiar with all these scenarios and has prepared itself accordingly. Over the past two decades, and even after the Zionist regime's recent attack, Iran's primary effort has consistently been to follow a legal and legitimate path, cooperate with international institutions, and rebuild international confidence in its nuclear program, not merely the confidence of Western governments. In my view, the most likely scenario is that Iran will once again pursue a legal process to disrupt and counter this Western strategy against it.
That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Until next time, take care.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners of Iran Radio. Thank you for staying with us throughout the day. As the hours unfold, we're pleased to bring you more thoughtful and engaging programs. Let's begin with News This Hour, bringing you the latest headlines and major developments from across the globe. Following the news, we continue with a fresh segment of Radio Productions, a curated selection of enriching audio pieces, thoughtfully prepared to enhance your listening experience. Then it's time for A to Z of Life with Sister Zainab James. This inspiring program explores the Islamic Iranian way of life through various dimensions, drawing from verses.
Israel has sparked alarm after announcing it will open the Rafah crossing, but only to let Palestinians leave Gaza. The UN General Assembly has voted to extend UNRWA's mandate through June 2029, with the US standing among the few rejecting the measure. In Yemen's southeast, tensions escalate as UAE-backed separatist forces tighten their grip on key provinces. Live from Tehran, I am Bahman Nouri, and this is News. Israel has triggered a wave of concern after announcing it will open the crucial Rafah crossing between Gaza and Egypt, but only for Palestinians to exit the coastal strip. Gaza mediators Egypt and Qatar, as well as six other Muslim-majority countries, have expressed their, quote, deep concern about the plan for a one-way exit for transfer of Gaza residents to Egypt. The statement was issued by Jordan, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and the United Arab Emirates, along with the Gaza mediators. Israel's announcement envisions no return for Gaza residents to their homeland. That has raised fears of permanent displacement of Palestinians, a concept that the hardliners' cabinet of the Israeli Premier Benjamin Netanyahu